Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 328 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Chris Westwood explains how a reset period in a fresh location helped him both to recover his creative writing self and to understand what had happened to disable it. Then Emma Darwin recalls the early days of online writing communities and explains how her popular blog, This Itch of Writing, came into being. First, here's Chris Westwood with Breakpoint.
It's late April and I've just arrived in Eastbourne, where I'll spend the next 10 days. 10 days of peace and solitude, in theory. A friend has offered up her place in the old town. It's mine for the duration, and she thinks the break, the change of scenery, will help my writing. My other half, Jill, thinks so too. But I'm not so sure. I travelled here today in part to please other people. It should be a great opportunity to pick up the pieces of a stalled career, but I swore off writing a year ago, and I'm not really in a hurry to start over. I'd stopped before, but not like this. I'd seen stories fizzle out within a few pages as if they didn't want to be written, while others ran aground halfway through, leaving me stranded for months. But more than this, there were family problems, unrelated to writing. My father suffered a stroke, and for 7 years while I looked after him, I hardly wrote a word. No surprise, I hadn't quit, I'd just chosen to be there and do what had to be done. Storytelling, making stuff up, now seemed trivial. And after Dad passed away, it took an age before I had the urge to write again. Perhaps whatever came next might help me deal with the loss, come to terms with it. And eventually I found an idea, or it found me, which allowed me to do just that. Although on the surface it was a children's book, a gothic fantasy for middle grade readers, it was also my way of putting the demons to rest. Writing as therapy, as a kind of self-help, a way of saying goodbye and letting go. The novel, sold to a small independent publisher, did pretty well, picked up some positive reviews, was shortlisted for awards, even won one, my first ever win. While I'd been working on it, the story had somehow outgrown and reshaped itself into the first part of an unplanned-for trilogy, not the standalone novel I'd expected. I took a deep breath and settled down for the long haul, and had finished the sequel when my publisher was bought out by corporate book packagers whose first act as new owners was to cancel the young adult fiction list. Fellow authors had their contracts returned. The editorial team were made redundant, and the final part of my trilogy went into limbo before I'd even started it. After years of not writing and the long process of recovery and starting over, I'd made it all the way back here for this. My friends kept me going. "Finish the story for yourself. Finish it for us," they said. It became a stop-start journey with many diversions and wrong turns which eventually took 5 years to complete. And as I worked, I thought, what's the point? What's the point of doing this when it has no future? No new publisher would touch the orphaned third book in a series when rights to the previous two were tied up elsewhere. But I did finish it, and having finished, I decided enough was enough. It's just too damn hard, I thought, and the well has run dry. But now, stepping into the house in Eastbourne, I remember I have a deadline. I've promised to write a short story for a friend's upcoming 60th birthday. It's still a few weeks away, and this is the only gift she wants from me, and I don't want to disappoint her, but I don't know where to start. I have no ideas and no appetite, only this innate reluctance to try. Perhaps if I try not to think of it, it will go away. I unpack, go out for groceries, heading down the steep hill to the shops on Green Street. 15 minutes down there, close to 25 minutes back. I'm surprised by the physical effort required, accustomed as I am to the flat East London parks close to where I live. Already I'm feeling muscles I'd forgotten I had. Back at the house, I settle in and drift through the evening, not a thought in my head about work. Next morning, I take a cup of tea to the living room where I sit and stare around at the walls and the ceiling. It's early and in the empty house, in semi-darkness, a slow sinking feeling comes over me and I think, now what do I do? I can't fritter away the next 10 days gazing into space, can I? What the hell will I do? I go to the kitchen and look out at the garden, one level below, with its small square of lawn and its patio table and chairs. I've written here at this house before, but not down there, in the garden, always in the dim sheltered alley beside the house. The alley has a partial view of one side of the garden, and this has always been my spot, seated there among the gardening tools and dusty brooms and spiders' webs, the nearest thing I could find to a writer's shed. Without another thought, I take off outside and down the stone steps to bring a chair up to the alley, dusting it off ready for use. As I settle on the chair and begin sharpening pencils, I'm still thinking, now what will I do? Maybe a few inspirational quotes will help. What will become my new daily mantra? Be open and receptive. Anything is possible. I remember Hemingway. You have written before, and you will write now. All you need to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence you know. And Ray Bradbury, don't think. Thinking is the enemy of creativity. Yes, I've done altogether too much thinking about this already, and see where it's got me. It's been so long since I held a pencil. My handwriting is clumsy, cramped, barely recognisable as my own. My whole body seems averse to doing this. But I write about not having written. I write about me sitting here now, not knowing what to write. I'm writing about not writing. But even writing about not writing is writing, so that's okay. And it's better than staring at the walls for 10 days. An hour passes, 2 hours, and I squeeze out 5 pages in a small Muji notebook and make more tea. It's a start, and I feel relieved. Not as empty as before. Tired, but in a good way. I wake early the next morning, already thinking ahead to the alley, trying not to think of what I'll write. I'll surprise myself. Yesterday I managed 5 pages. Today I'll aim for 6. It's a mechanical approach, going through the motions, but I'm glad the impulse to do it at all hasn't faded overnight. My hand doesn't feel so constrained this time. The handwriting is smaller and tidier, not as small as it will be when it returns to its normal size, at which point I'll need glasses to read what I'm writing. The morning sun is up, and below my workspace 2 jackdaws hop around the branches of a tree. My thoughts seem to hop around with them, anxious and unsettled. But I write 6 notebook pages all the same. Now I'm writing about having written. The house, way up the hill above the shops, stands below an even steeper climb on East Dean Road leading to the South Downs Way. I start to think that if I can make it all the way up the hill, sweating and straining towards the golf course and onto the downs, if I can do that every day, the walk will gradually become easier. And as the land flattens out towards the cliffs, I'll be rewarded with fantastic views over the town and out to sea. And if I can do that, surely I can produce 6 notebook pages a day. Who knows, sooner or later the muse may wake up, the gears may turn, ideas may surface. I still remember how much fun it used to be when writing came easily, and perhaps it will be that way again. And so I set off uphill. A change in the weather. On day 3, sitting out under cover in the alley while a fierce cold wind drives hard rain across the streets, I lose myself in writing for the first time, forgetting where I am. Everywhere there's a sound of rushing water, overflowing gutters and wheelie bins toppling in the street, A stepladder crashes in the alley behind me. It was a dark and stormy morning, I write, wondering if I'm losing my mind. Why should writing come more easily in the eye of the storm than in a nice cosy room with a view? But when I look back at what I've done, I find 13, 14 pages of notes, including the bare bones of a short story I don't even recognise. Where did that come from? It's as if someone took over the wheel while I was daydreaming, steering me on a course I hadn't planned for. Something is happening. What is this strange and unfamiliar positive feeling? From my notes, verbatim, quitting as a form of self-defence. To avoid distress, I'll not engage. To avoid the disappointment of not winning the lottery, I'll not buy a ticket. Things have fallen apart and it's not my fault, it's everyone else's. And I'll spare myself further pain by giving up, investing no more time. And then I've written, who am I kidding? Who precisely am I depriving? Somewhere inside me there's a reactionary who thinks the way to get even with the suits who crash my party is to withhold my work, as if they care. Meanwhile, the publishing world is silent. No queries, no calls, no emails. I am the world's forgotten boy. Well, I'll show them. If they can go silent, so can I. And out of petulance, I stop writing. Scribbling this down as fast as I can to avoid losing it, I begin to see what I've been doing to myself all along. Self-sabotage. Behind all the reticence and negativity, there's fear. Fear of failure. Fear of rejection. This train of thought reminds me of something. I have to strain to remember, but then I have it. An interview with filmmaker Paul Schrader in a Making of Taxi Driver documentary I saw years ago. When I set out to write the Taxi Driver script, Schrader said, I thought it was about loneliness. And then when I wrote it, I realised it was about something a little different and more interesting, which was self-imposed loneliness. That is, a syndrome of behaviour that reinforces itself. And the touchstones of that kind of behaviour are all kinds of contradictory impulses, puritanism and pornography at the same time. I've got to get healthy while popping pills at the same time. It's all full of these things he, Travis Bickle, does to make sure he'll never get where he's going. In other words, so he can reinforce his own doomed condition. It's what I'd been feeling for so long but had never articulated. I'd stopped writing to spite others and I'd only hurt myself, making sure I would never succeed. A kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of failure, so that at any time in the midst of writing I might say, why bother? What's the point? The little A6 notebook fills with these musings. Now I'm reaching 14, 15 pages a day, now 20. And like the challenging hikes up the Eastbourne Hills, the writing becomes easier, almost effortless, which is how I become aware I'm not doing it alone. The story I discovered earlier in the week begins to take shape. Flesh creeps over its bones. By writing something, writing anything, every day, I find that the impulse, the need, the will to do it is still there. My mojo is back. I'm reconnecting with the muse, who's done most of the work already without my knowledge. And there I was, thinking the old unconscious had left me for good, and all along it, or he, or she, was only sleeping. The lines of communication were cut when I stopped, and I've missed our little chats, our little brainstorming sessions. It's amazing to see what's possible when you don't put your mind to it. Again, the daily mantra. Be open and receptive. Again, I think of Hemingway. Maybe away from Paris, I could write about Paris, as in Paris, I could write about Michigan. He called it transplanting oneself. Not just describing what's there in front of you, but reimagining it in another place at another time. You see places more clearly when you're not there. So suddenly I'm in Greece, and the story this has been leading to is a melancholy one. its narrator revisiting an island where he and his parents once made memories together. Years after they've passed away, he returns to search for them again, or at least for the traces they left behind. In a sense, it's also a story about me, the writer, revisiting old haunts to find what once made him tick. Maybe I want to become a writer again. The stormy weather passes, the sky turns clear and blue, and on my last day, seated on a bench on the sunlit seafront, I see all the colours, all the sights and sounds of Crete that will make their way into the story. The story isn't finished by the time I leave Eastbourne, but now I'm back on speaking terms with the muse, I'm not thinking about failure anymore. Besides, I have a deadline. That birthday will be here before I know it. The only doubt in my mind as the train sets off is that 2 hours from now, I'll be back in flat East London. And what will I do when I have no more hills to climb?
That was Chris Westwood, recorded by himself. You can find out more about Chris on his website at www.chris-westwood.com. Next, here's Emma Darwin with On Writing, Blogging and Not Doing Your Homework.
When my first book was published back in the Pleistocene era, the way real humans found other real human beings with similar tastes and interests was in online forums and in the comments trails on the blogs. Some early bloggers, such as Neil Gaiman, began blogging to support and increase an existing readership. Others began to blog and created a readership ripe for a book deal, as Julie Powell did with Julie and Julia. Because the book trade was panting to sign bloggers and their ready-made following, it became received industry wisdom that starting a blog was how authors could get attention, be discovered, gain readers, and sell books. I was an unknown debut novelist, and of course I wanted all those things to happen for me. But what did you put in a blog? I nosed around online and realised there were essentially two kinds of blog. In the first, the blogger writes about their own life and thoughts with a voice and point of view enjoyable in itself. Readers come back to see what the blogger's on about today. But it was no good asking myself to keep that kind of blog. The writer's life is a notoriously dull business of keeping the seat of your pants on the seat of your chair so you can stare at a blank and silent screen. Even I find my life only intermittently interesting. I certainly didn't and don't expect anyone else to care tuppence about it. The second kind of blog is the kind which sets out to be useful or interesting about a specific topic. Jack Monroe's Cooking on a Bootstrap would be a relatively recent example, or Essie Fox's Virtual Victorian. Readers arrive because they're drawn to the topic, and stay because the blogger goes on delivering what they want. The blogger's personality is always going to shape the blog, but it's secondary. But no one had heard of me, and what would I blog about? I don't talk about my work in progress to anyone beyond my agent and a trusted friend or two, and I don't publish books often enough to have a permanent stream of events to promote and then report on. True, the material of my fiction, history, is wonderful for blogging. But I'm always fighting against people's tendency to read and promote historical fiction in terms of its non-fiction value, because that sets a novel up to be read and judged in a wrong-headed spirit against the wrong set of criteria. My goal is always to write so that what I've researched, what I've remembered, and what I've invented are indistinguishable, giving the reader the same vivid sting of the real. Even when I find a truly juicy bit of historical stuff, I resist my urge to tell everyone about it and force myself to hoard it privately so I can bend it to the will and the needs of my story. Many novelists feel the opposite. Elizabeth Chadwick blogs regularly not only about the historical material that she seeks, draws on and works with, but also about how the actual writing is going. "I blog as the whim strikes, and for me," she says. But the blogs always have added value for an audience. That added value seems to me crucial for a blog to be satisfying to read, which is the only way it will be satisfying to write, that the reader gets more than just a teaser, a trailer, or a sales blurb. which isn't to say that sales aren't a welcome byproduct. Researcher and non-fiction author Helen Cara describes this kind of blogging as self-promotion the way I like to do it, by providing a service to my professional community. Literary scholar Farah Mendelssohn also blogs and tweets her research as she goes along. She blogged continuously as she wrote a book on the English Civil War in children's historical fiction, and in doing so made great friends and connections. So if blogging has a complicated relationship with the writer's real writing, it's not separate from their life either. We've mostly forgotten that blog is short for weblog, but some blogger writers blog for the same reason that many writers keep journals, as a way of keeping the writing muscles moving, checking in with the longitude and latitude of their life, and sorting out whatever they're thinking about, or fretting about, or dreaming of today. For this kind of blogger, the size or type of a readership may not matter very much. Poet Sheena Pugh uses her blog as a less ephemeral place to post stuff than Facebook. She blogs about work methods, posts reviews, and has her say on current controversies in writing. Her blog is a decades-old hangout for fellow poets and writers, but this COVID year she has mostly posted reviews, she says, because she feels sorry for writers who've missed out on launches and events. Novelist and poet Judy Moore says her blog is 95% books I'm reviewing, because it's the only way I can keep up a regular-ish strike rate on the blog. And who wants to read about why or how I write, she adds. There are loads of much better writers than me blogging that. But though, of course, I read and think about what I read, much of it connects to the work in progress that I'm so determined to keep quiet about. And besides, the thought of having to write regularly and organisedly about it, well, it felt like giving myself homework, and I am a lifelong dodger of homework. I'm also one of the writers who don't write unless we have a visible route to an audience and some way of knowing that the audience is listening. That's not just vanity. Time that I'm spending on blogging is time I'm not spending on other kinds of writing that will find readers. I have to work out some kind of profit and loss. It was also clear that just as you have to keep putting food on the bird table if you want the birds to keep coming back, you have to keep putting food out for your readers. 3 times a week is the minimum to get a blog going, most committed bloggers would tell you, and every day is better. So what on earth was I not only willing but able to write about 3 times a week for the foreseeable future? The answer, of course, was writing itself. Long ago, I'd spent some years working in publishing and reading The Bookseller, and my debut novel, The Mathematics of Love, had also got me an MPhil in creative writing. I was a site expert on one of the major writing forums and was working on my second novel, A Secret Alchemy, as part of a PhD while teaching creative writing for the Open University. And I was still spending a good deal of my leisure time online discussing, arguing, explaining and commiserating with aspiring writers and my author friends. So next, I needed a name for the blog. But there were an awful lot of writers' blogs out there, and the titles tended to feature notes, leaves, thoughts, and lines. I needed something different, with at least one word the search engines would pounce on. Did I mention that I want readers? In a letter to a friend, John Dunn says that he's been waiting to write until he has some news from London to pass on, but since there hasn't been any, he's writing anyway, to scratch this itch of writing. So I called my blog This Itch of Writing, and in my first post I said that I wasn't sure what was going to happen or what I would write about, but together we would find out. Because that's one of the good things about blogging. You can make it up as you go along. If you use one of the free platforms, it costs nothing but time, so you really can just put some posts out there and see what happens. Early mistakes soon drop out of sight, and any changes of direction can be gradual. In any case, you're in conversation with your readers now and can tell them what's happening. Of course, we're now in the decade of Instagram, vlogging and millionaire YouTube influencers. Bloggers whose blog is their creative output and their livelihood are infinitely strategic and targeted. They pore over their stats and analyse traffic sources and search terms. They monetize recommendations and pitch for advertising. They optimize tweet schedules for different time zones and make sure their followers feel loved and never neglected. But if it's not your livelihood, you don't have to be strategic. When journalist and scriptwriter William Gallagher lost most of his work at the BBC, he found he really missed the deadlines. Blogging about writing and drama at self-distract was meant, he says, just for me. The self-generated pressure to find something new to write each week was what he needed to keep going. He never looks at audience numbers, though when he accidentally posted on a Thursday, not a Friday, he got emails from readers who felt the whole week had been thrown out of gear. Clearly someone was listening, hard and often. So I was going to blog about writing and the life that comes with it. But in what way? If there were no rules about what a blog must do, not even minimum and maximum word counts in print. There were also few guidelines about what it could do. I had newspaper columns in mind, but my real model was Letter from America, which was broadcast weekly on Radio 4 for 50 years and which I got addicted to as a child. Almost without fail, Cook began his 15 minutes with some vignette or anecdote, then broadened out to talk about what it illuminated, explained, or contradicted in the life and times of his adopted country. Always he was relaxed and conversational, but also coherent. And when you read the scripts, you realise how beautifully structured they are, leading the listener through to the conclusion, which was always the kind which in academic writing I call the so what paragraph, the reason why what we've heard was worth hearing. Analysing Letter from America, I formed my one rule for the itch. I would talk about my writing or professional life, especially around publication time, but only as a jumping off point. Every piece must have some actual meat for someone who didn't care at all what I was personally doing. As my sister Sophie, who is a maths lecturer, says to her students when they've made some observation, the next question is always, can you generalise from that? It's the wider idea that is the answer to so what. It helped that mine is the first generation of writers who made their best, longest-standing writing friends hanging out in the writing forums. Then none of us were published. Now most of us are, and in every possible kind of writing. The thing is, 9 times out of 10, the goal of any writer is good writing that catches and holds the readers they're writing for. It's just that different writers set about getting the right words onto the page in different ways, and different readers are gripped by different means. So whatever I think about how my writing works, I know that the absolute opposite will be true for someone else. And on the itch, I do my best to offer the readers those opposite ways and perspectives too. By now, alongside writing, I was teaching and blogging about fiction, giving writing workshops, mentoring individual writers, and working with academic writing as a Royal Literary Fund Fellow. All these raised a constant stream of questions and ideas, in students and in me, about how words and stories and writing work, and how writers work, keep going, change tack, or earn a living. Encountering a question or a common problem, I would go off to the blog to work it out as much for myself as anyone else. I found that I helped students with that topic much better for having got a properly thought-out post about it up on the itch, and then the comments would get me thinking even further. Another benefit for me and the writers I help is that in the mad 10-minute one-to-one feedback sessions at the writers' conferences, I can simply say, you need to get a handle on the difference between showing and telling. There's a big post on the blog about it. Sometimes I post out of fury at the nonsense that gets peddled to aspiring writers. There's the idea that you should cut every sentence with was in it, or that you should write what you know, or never move point of view, or that old canard, show, don't tell. Gradually, my more ruminative posts on writing and the life that comes with it grew fewer, and the big how-to posts took over. That was partly because I hugely enjoyed doing them, and they were useful to me, but also because you'll always get more people reading something if it's clear at the outset what they'll get out of it. From how to make your character's introspection dynamic, to ways to defeat procrastination, from psychic distance to giving a reading, from creative refueling to how a subordinate adverbial clause of purpose might just help your writing to sing, the toolkit section of the blog grew and grew. True, in crude profit and loss terms, the blog appears to cost me money. I don't have advertising because I want to control what shows up on my blog. And I don't have affiliate links because I don't want trying to optimise clicks to mess with my sense of what the blog and the readers need today. So the writing takes time, but I'm not paid to do it. And yet it does generate revenue indirectly. People ask me to mentor them after discovering the itch, and organisers wondering whether to book me can see that I know what I'll be talking about. I'm careful not to go on about my own books too much or too often, but blog readers do even buy them. The itch has made other things happen too. Shortly after I saw a startling number of hits on my relatively few posts about historical fiction, I got an email from a commissioning editor, and Get Started in Writing Historical Fiction was under contract 6 weeks later. And I'm fairly sure that my most recent book, This Is Not a Book About Charles Darwin, A Writer's Journey Through My Family, wouldn't exist at all if feeding the blog hadn't kept me thinking week in, week out, about how stories are told, how writing happens, how fiction works, and what's going on when all three of those things go horribly, horribly wrong. I'm not alone in finding that my desire to communicate outwards brings unexpected rewards. Sheena Pugh reckons her blog helps her to keep thinking critically, and reviewing keeps her in touch with books she wouldn't otherwise read. And William Gallagher's blog, Just For Me, has sparked a parallel career running workshops on blogging as freelance work for journalists, as well as bagging him freelance work for himself because his blog appealed to the CEO. Agents, editors, tutors and mentors send writers they're working with to the itch. And I know when it's Psychic Distance Week at the Open University MA, because there's a surge in the hits on that post. Many other universities and writing courses link to it too, and every now and again they ask me to run a workshop or give a talk. There's another payoff, which you could call ethical. Despite my own MPhil and PhDs in creative writing, I hate it when people talk as if you, or they themselves, can't be a writer without doing courses and gaining some kind of qualification. All you actually need to be a writer is time, a chair, the desire to write better, and something to write on. If the something does Wi-Fi, you can help yourself to as much of the itch as is useful to you, in whatever order is useful, absolutely gratis. The big how-to posts on the itch take time, though, and these days I don't blog nearly so often, and yes, the stats would look better if I did. On the other hand, if my real writing has hit a tough patch, the fact that I can put out a blog post and immediately see the retweets, the comments, the uptick in the stats, is much-needed nourishment for my writing self. Because that's the thing about blogging. You don't answer to anyone but yourself. Sheena Pugh says her blog never impedes her writing because she doesn't let it. And how I balance blogging with the rest of my life is my choice. I'll take the consequences. There's no publisher, no editor, teacher or academic administrator to say me nay. If the needs of the itch are always subordinate to the needs of my creative writing, then, well, that's just the itch embodying its own underlying values. Either readers like it and stay, or they don't and wander off elsewhere. It's a big place, the blogosphere, and there's room for us all.
That was Emma Darwin, recorded by Anne Morgan. You can find out more about Emma on her website at www.emmadarwin.com. And that concludes episode 328, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 329, in our ongoing Poetry Break series, Nicholas Murray and Julia Copus discuss classic poems by Robert Frost. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.